If you think we live in a post-racial society, think again.
My definition of being in a post-racial society would be one where race is not predictive of anything, and that's certainly not the case.
You're pretty much going to be right if you assume that blacks and Latinos are not doing quite so well and whites and Asians are.
Statistically speaking, being born black or Latino or Native American is associated with some relatively bad outcomes. From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer Guerra. Over the next hour, we'll look at schools.
Michigan has an absolute national leader in segregated schools.
And neighborhoods.
It's not a good place to live. I don't feel like it's an excellent place to live, but I mean, it's not the worst place to be.
I wouldn't raise my kids over there. I'm just saying.
And the role race plays in both. That's ahead on State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. But first, this news. It's time to have the talk. I know it's not going to be easy. Might make you a little uncomfortable, maybe make you squirm a little, but it's time. I'm Jennifer Guerra with Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project, and for the next hour, we are going to be talking about race. Now, I know some of you listening right now are probably thinking, race? Really? It's 2013. Aren't we past all this by now? Good. I was hoping you'd ask that.
Hello?
Hi, is this Katie?
Yeah.
Hey, Katie, it's Jennifer.
Hi.
I want you to meet two young girls, both freshmen at a high school in Grand Haven, Michigan. Their names are Katie, age 15, and Destiny, age 14. Both girls are mixed, half white, half black. They describe their skin as caramel colored, and they're pretty much inseparable.
Yeah, we are. We each other's half.
That's really cool. Yeah, you finish each other's sentences a lot. How long have you been friends?
I'm a year and a half.
The two girls ride the bus together to school every day. And that's where the trouble started.
Me and my friend, me and Dee Dee.
Destiny.
We were sitting on the bus, and this girl was saying how blacks should go back to Africa and Hispanics should go back to Mexico, and this world would be better if it was just Caucasians. And her friend that she was telling it to was like, well, you better be careful because there's two black girls behind you. And the girl said, well, they can go back to Africa.
How'd that make you feel?
Mad. And unwelcoming.
This wasn't some isolated incident. The girls tell me about the boy who wore a KKK mask in the cafeteria, another one who wore it during homecoming weekend. Then there was the time a boy came up to Katie when she was taking a test, and he made a joke about slavery and has she picked any cotton lately. And then there was another school bus incident. I want to warn you that what Destiny and Katie are about to say uses a racial term listeners may find offensive.
Well, me and Katie, we were getting on the bus. And there weren't any seats in the front. So we decided to go to the back. And then these two dudes were like, why don't you guys sit back here all the time? Aren't blacks supposed to sit at the back of the bus? And I didn't think Katie heard it, so I just let it go. And then what else did they say?
And then we sat down, and I heard, do you know how, like, people use the term, oh, that's gay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, some dude fell and was like, oh, you're such a nigger. And then there was like five dudes in the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And the guy said to another guy, was like, would you ever date a black girl? And he was like, yeah, just like light-skinned ones. And he's like, there's those light-skinned niggers over there. And he's like, would you date them? He said, no, they have nappy hair. And he was like, I'll give you $5 if you go F one of them. And he was like, no, I would never F a nigger.
Do you feel safe at school?
No.
No.
I have people that walk me to class.
And so do I.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You mean adults or other friends?
Friends.
Why, what do you think is going to happen?
I don't know. Something might come up.
Yeah. That's why I don't use the bathroom during school anymore. I'm afraid, like, whoever would follow me in the bathroom and do whatever. I mean, if five guys have the guts to say that, you don't know what five guys would do.
True.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Katie and Destiny in Grand Haven aren't the only two in America being harassed because of their skin color. Doesn't sound quite like the post-racial society a lot of folks claim we live in today. And it's not just overt racism that we're talking about.
My definition of being in a post-racial society would be one where race is not predictive of anything. And that's certainly not the case.
Stephen Raphael is a public policy professor at UC Berkeley.
So it's still the case that today just knowing a child's race, or knowing an adult's race for that matter, will on average predict a number of outcomes. And it almost uniformly tends to be the case that African Americans fare worse on average on most outcomes.
When we take the major racial groups in the United States, blacks, whites, Latinos, and Asian Americans, you could basically take whites and Asian Americans as one side of a distribution and blacks and Latinos as the other side of the distribution. You're pretty much going to be right if you assume that blacks and Latinos are not doing quite so well and whites and Asians are.
David Harris is a provost at Tufts University and co-editor of a book called The Colors of Poverty. He says, and there are mountains of evidence to back this up, that if you are born black in the U.S., you are less likely than a white person to make it to your first birthday. You're less likely to have a college degree, more likely to have a parent in jail, live in a bad neighborhood with underperforming schools and high crime, and you are considerably more likely to wind up involved in the criminal justice system. Substitute Latino or Native American in place of black, and the outcomes are pretty similar. And when you think about how our population is growing into this majority-minority, those statistics start to take on a new weight. Take all these outcomes and combine them with historical discrimination like redlining and studies like the one that shows employers are more likely to hire an individual with a white-sounding name than a black-sounding one, and you've got what Harris calls cumulative disadvantage.
It's that old idea in part from the 1960s, which was that you can't have individuals run a race, one of whom has a weighted vest, the other of whom doesn't, take the weight off and say everything's equal, move on. You have a different starting condition because of the history. So race matters in direct and indirect ways.
Let's stay with that analogy for just a minute. What if there was a program that said, look, we can't remove the vest entirely, but what if we could lighten it up considerably?
My name is Mr. Blackman, and I represent Black Family Development, and we have a program called Promise Neighborhood based on a program that started in Harlem with a frustrated educator named Jeffrey Canada.
Derek Blackman and has knocked on more than 2,000 doors in Detroit's Osborne neighborhood, and each time he gives this exact same spiel. In the spiel, he talks about how a guy named Jeffrey Canada took two of the worst blocks in Harlem.
Actually, two of the blocks were in the movie American Gangster with Denzel. Did you see that? Okay, well,
and deployed a whatever it takes approach to help those kids in Harlem beat the odds. A decade later, the grand experiment known as the Harlem Children's Zone is by all measures a success. It's now a 100-block zone in the heart of Harlem with a safety net that starts at birth and goes all the way through college. Derek Blackman and his team at Black Family Development, they want to do the same thing for kids here in Detroit. And they're calling it Promise Neighborhood.
If they can do that in Harlem, they can do that anywhere. So, ma'am, sir, welcome to anywhere.
The anywhere, Blackman shows me, is a neighborhood called Osborne. It's a mostly black neighborhood with one of the highest crime rates in Detroit. It also has a high vacancy rate, which is obvious as he drives me around from block to block. Unemployment is high, poverty is high. The average household income in Osborne is around $12,000 a year.
So this is Hoover, our western border.
We pass by drug houses, a gas station where Blackman says lots of shootings take place, an abandoned house on a corner where a man attempted to rape a young girl. More than a third of the people living in Osborne are children under the age of 18. And this is what they're confronted with every day they step outside their front door. Children like 10-year-old Jaleesa.
Who says you're not perfect? Who says you're the only one deserving? Touch me, that's the matter, beauty. Who said?
Jaleesa put on her mini American Idol performance for me in the cafeteria at Brenda Scott Elementary, where she's in third grade. Brenda Scott is one of the lowest performing schools in Detroit. Jaleesa is a sensitive kid with a big heart. And when you ask her what she wants to be when she grows up, it's a no-brainer.
I want to be a singer.
Jaleesa's mom, Phyllis Dotson, dropped by the school to sign up her daughter for Black Family Development's new Promise Neighborhood pilot program.
Okay, Miss Dotson, we want you to take these here.
There are five or so tables in this enrollment room. Each table has an official-sounding name, like Intake Station and Quality Review Station. The enrollees make their way from one station to the next, not quite sure what they're signing their kids up for. They just hope it's for something better than they already have. We'll catch up with Jaleesa's mom in a minute, but first, a little explainer. The reason it's called a pilot program is because there is no real Promise Neighborhood in Detroit yet. The Obama administration came up with the Promise Neighborhood competition several years ago. Cities with the best plan to lift up a struggling community get to win the big bucks. Black Family Development won a $500,000 planning grant a couple years ago, but when they went to apply for the full $6 million to implement the plan, they got shut out. Instead, Promise Neighborhood money went to D.C. and states like California, Massachusetts, Texas, and Mississippi. So Black Family Development is rolling out this pilot program. They will enroll 140 kids, like Jaleesa, and track them on everything from attendance to tutoring to after-school programs. The goal is to include the new data when they go to apply again this summer to try to win money to bring Promise Neighborhoods to Detroit. The 140 kids will come from five schools and two neighborhoods in Detroit: Osborne, an overwhelmingly Black neighborhood where Jaleesa lives, and Clark Park, a mostly Latino neighborhood in southwest Detroit.
So instead, we'll ask you if you wouldn't mind filling it out.
Back in the enrollment room, I catch up with Jaleesa's mom, Phyllis Dotson. Like a majority of residents in Osborne, Dotson relies on food stamps and cash assistance to get by. Up until late last year, she and her kids were homeless and living out of the family van. Dotson tells me she's got some medical problems and can't work, so she spends her days volunteering. I asked her why she wants to enroll Jaleesa and her two siblings, Adam and Nakia, in the Promise Neighborhood pilot.
They can be more educated on a lot of the stuff, that far as their schoolwork, the teacher with their homework and everything. So mainly their knowledge. They can pick up on a lot of stuff that they're not really getting right now. Because I think Jaleesa, she's been back three grades because they say about her attendance, which is true, because I had to catch the bus with them. Then when it got even colder, I didn't get up and catch the bus. That's my fault. I know that. But, yeah.
Do you want Adam, Jaleesa, and Nakia to go to college?
Oh, yes, definitely, yes. I want them to go and become doctors, lawyers, whatever they can be to be it. I tell them like this every day. Be better than your mom.
Be better than your mom. That's what every parent hopes for, right? I mean, that's the American dream. You work hard, do well by others, and eventually you will become more successful than your parents. Opportunity and wealth are supposed to grow with each generation. But in neighborhoods like Osborne and Clark Park, where houses are abandoned and stripped, resources have dwindled, gangs run the blocks, schools are underperforming, jobs are scarce, what kind of opportunity do these African American and Latino kids really have? A study by the Kerwin Institute at Ohio State University shows that fully 90% of African American children in Michigan live in what are called low opportunity neighborhoods, like Osborne. More than half of Latino children in Michigan and 43% of Native American children live in low opportunity neighborhoods. When it comes to white children, the percentage is significantly lower, just under 20%. That means the vast majority of white children live in neighborhoods where the streetlights work and cops come when you call, where there are good schools and a viable job market. The same can't be said for the vast majority of children of color.
Hi, my name is Shakiria Harris Bay. I'm 16.
I'm Navia Daniel, and I'm in 10th grade.
Hi, my name is Tanisha George. I'm 16, and I'm in 10th grade.
Shakiria, Navia, and Tanisha live on the west side of Detroit in a neighborhood called Brightmoor. They share what it's like to grow up in a low-opportunity neighborhood like theirs.
There's certain parts of Brightmoor that's good, and there's certain parts that's bad.
It's a lot of abandoned houses on my street. I think it's 4 and 1 that somebody's squatting in. I don't even know what that's about.
A house, abandoned house next to ours. Then, like, it's 4 houses. Then across the street is an abandoned house.
It's not a good place to live. I don't feel like it's an excellent place to live, but, I mean, it's not the worst place to be.
I wouldn't raise my kids over there. I'm just saying.
I want my kids to have better than I had, right. So.
But then again, how we got raised, we still came out okay. We still not into all that stuff that they've been doing, you know what I'm saying? Other people, girls end up getting pregnant, having sex, smoking weed, you know. And then the boys just gangs all day.
For boys, I feel like it's harder because if you a boy, it's almost mandatory for you to be in a gang. Like, if you don't rep a gang, then it's like, what's wrong with you? And it's really pushed upon them. Like, it's not like something they just choose to do. If you grow up in a house on Brightmoor and you a boy, you are most likely to become a Crip, and that is the end of that. Like, that's it. You have a lot of good days, but most of the days is not so good if you're around that kind of stuff.
I think I carry on because I just think about the future. Like, I'm gonna get out of here, you know. I'm gonna leave, go wherever I need to go to college.
Yeah. Everything will get better eventually. I mean, you gotta keep a positive mindset. That's how I learned. Just stay positive until it's over, and then you get to do whatever you want to do and be whoever you want to be. You don't have to think about it. That's it.
That was Tanisha George and her fellow classmates Shakiria Harris Bay and Navia Daniel, all residents of the Brightmoor neighborhood in Detroit. Coming up, when it comes to out-of-school suspensions, guess which group of students is 3 times more likely to get suspended than any other group? The answer, in 10 minutes. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. From Michigan Radio, this is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer Guerra. The topic this hour, race. You know, when I told people I was working on this special one-hour show about race, a lot of the reactions I got were along the lines of, oh, race. Interesting. Like, man, I am glad I do not have your job. That's because the topic of race is fraught. People hear it and they run for the hills. But researcher Rebecca Bigler says when we don't talk about it, when we don't address the issue of race, say, or gender, that's when the trouble starts. For nearly 2 decades, psychologist Rebecca Bigler at the University of Texas has been testing race and gender ideas with kids using colored T-shirts in a summer school program.
So we put this whole room of kids in shirts that are red or blue. And when you walk into this school that we use, it's the first thing that you notice that there are all these red and blue kids.
The first colored T-shirt experiment Bigler ran was in the early 1990s. My colleague, Dustin Dwyer, interviewed Bigler about it. Let's let him take it from here.
For this one, Bigler had the teachers talk about T-shirt colors the way teachers usually talk about gender.
So they said, good morning, reds and blues line up, and let's sit red, blue, what a good blue group member. And so the teachers were never biased. They were never unfair. They never linked the groups to traits. But what we found is when the teachers labeled those groups, just like in the case of gender, the kids became biased.
By the end of the summer, reds were more likely to have a high opinion of reds. Blues were more likely to have a high opinion of blues. Next, Bigler wondered about race. Race doesn't get labeled in classrooms today. Teachers don't stand in front of class and say, good morning, black kids and white kids. But kids are exposed to more subtle signals. They might notice that everyone on their block is the same race as them, or that kids of a different race often have different outcomes. So Bigler ran a study using posters at the school. Kids were told that the posters showed the outcomes for the previous year's class.
Essentially, what we did is show one group, for example, the blue group, winning all of the academic contests. It was only blue kids who read the most books over the summer, won the weekly spelling bees, won the math quizzes, showed the good behavior.
Left on their own, the kids would ignore the posters. But Bigler says when teachers made a big deal out of the t-shirt color groups, the posters became more important.
Then the high-status children became exceptionally biased. The highest levels of stereotyping and prejudice I've seen in any of our studies come when the teachers label the groups, and those posters in the room show that the kids' own group is a very successful group.
So what the kids learn from the teachers is that the t-shirt groups are important. What they learn from the posters is that one group is better than the other. You might hear this and think that the answer is just to ignore the groups, pretend that there is no difference. But Bigler says that won't work with race and gender. Kids can't avoid noticing these differences.
So the question really becomes, will now just ignoring and not labeling make those biases go away? And the answer is clearly no.
Bigler has done other studies where kids were just asked about race and gender. It turns out kids notice differences far more than adults realize. But if adults don't explain why differences exist, kids make up their own explanations. In a study in 2006, Bigler asked elementary school kids why there's never been a woman president. 20% of kids said it's because women are less qualified.
Now, most parents wouldn't want their child endorsing that belief, right? They don't want them to think the reason women aren't president of the United States is because they're incompetent.
But if parents don't explain why there's never been a woman president, kids won't know. Bigler says the lesson from the t-shirt studies is that kids pay attention to the differences between groups, no matter what differences you give them. But if you don't explain why the groups are different, kids will often assume that one group is just better than the other. So parents and teachers can't pretend there's no difference. They have to talk about the differences.
You're listening to a State of Opportunity special on race on Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. One place where parents and teachers are talking about race in the classroom is Birmingham, Michigan. Now, Birmingham is pretty much as white a city as they come, with a median household income around $100,000. Espresso bars and high-end restaurants and shops line the streets downtown, and there's a 4-star hotel where out-of-town celebrities stay whenever they visit Metro Detroit. From the looks of it, Birmingham has it all. But dig a little deeper, and Birmingham has a problem.
We have a huge achievement gap.
Closing the achievement gap.
Close the achievement gap.
That achievement gap is alive and well here in Birmingham right now.
That last voice you heard is Jason Klingscale, principal at Berkshire Middle School in Birmingham. When it comes to student performance on standardized tests, his district has some serious disparities between white and black students. And we are not talking about some 5 or 10 point difference. We are talking about a nearly 30-point difference in proficiency in math at the middle school level between white and black students. By the time those students reach 11th grade, the math gap is more than 50 points wide. Klingscale is an African-American with 2 daughters of his own. He uses words like sobering and frustrating to describe the achievement gap. And the gap isn't just on paper. I can see it play out from classroom to classroom.
What do we notice about our dependent
Take
variable.
Math, for example. In this lower-level math class for 7th and 8th graders, what's called essential math, minority students are way overrepresented. Half the class is African-American, even though black students make up less than a quarter of the school's population. Principal Klingscale then takes me into an advanced math class.
If we have 23% of our students that are African-American, you'd hope to see 23% of that advanced math class also being African-American.
Instead, in a sea of white faces, there is one minority student. Klingscale chairs the district's Achievement Gap Committee. To try to shrink the gap, they have weekly parent university classes for adults with topics like how to foster your child's responsibility and how to help children succeed. There are also more intervention classes for kids and Saturday school for those who need extra help. There are likely a number of contributing factors to explain Birmingham's big achievement gap. For starters, a lot of the black students don't start their education in the district. They often transfer in from schools in lower performing districts, which means they also might not have gotten the same kind of high quality early childhood education a lot of their white peers did. Donna Ford argues that teachers' expectations also play a key role in perpetuating the achievement gap. Ford is a professor of special education at Vanderbilt University.
So when you have low expectations, you're not likely to challenge the black students with critical thinking and problem solving. You're not likely to refer them for gifted education screening and placement. You're not likely to refer them for advanced placement classes. And also, you're more likely to refer them for special education, identification, and services.
Changing expectations is something Jason Klingscale says his district is working on. Now, Birmingham is not alone with its achievement gap. Michigan as a whole has one of the worst gaps in the country. So how to solve it? Well, obviously, there is no silver bullet. There is one group, though, that every expert I spoke to brought up as having the biggest impact on closing the gap: teachers.
Teaching quality is the number one in-school predictor of student achievement.
Amber Adiano is with Education Trust Midwest, a nonprofit dedicated to closing the achievement gap.
For a long time in Michigan, we've sort of put our hands up and said, well, they're poor, or they're black, or they're brown, and so there's not a whole lot that we can do about it. And now what's happened in the last 15 years is that there's been an explosion of really high-caliber research that showed that there are actually things that matter inside the school and what schools do and how they're organized.
What matters, she says, are highly effective teachers and rigorous curriculums with high-level math and science classes. But recent data from the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights show those two basic things are lacking in schools with high concentrations of Black and Latino students. Those schools are twice as likely to have teachers who get paid less and have less experience. Same goes for rigor. The higher the minority population in a school, the fewer honors and advanced classes offered. For Amber Adiano, figuring out how to close the achievement gap isn't just a job. It's personal.
You know, my daughter is 11 months old. She's Hispanic. And I think about it, I think to myself, is she going to be able to have a viable public education in Michigan? She's very clearly Latina in terms of her appearance, and that could have an impact in terms of her, the access to opportunities for her. And we are blessed in that we're a middle-class family, so we can move to a better school district. But there are thousands of parents that they can't. And it's just so deeply unfair.
I see you getting pretty emotional.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just, it's so tragic when you really think about the missed opportunities for kids.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's walk and talk, be in motion, people. Let's go.
Over at Pioneer High School in Ann Arbor, a town best known for its world-class university and athletics, there's another kind of gap at play, a discipline gap. Stand in the hallway at Pioneer, and you can pick out a few minority students here and there, but by and large, it's a white school. And yet, when it comes to who gets suspended, students of color far outnumber white students. The sad thing is, Ann Arbor is not unique. A new report by the Civil Rights Project at UCLA shows that during the 2009-10 school year, nearly one out of every three African-American high school boys was suspended. That's three times the rate of suspension for white boys.
I'm Cynthia Lehman, principal at Pioneer High School, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Lehman is new to Pioneer. She just joined the school 3 months ago, but she's been an educator for 35 years. Pioneer High School has one of the biggest discipline gaps in the district, so Lehman has got her work cut out for her. But she says she and the district have a plan, or rather, a philosophy.
A philosophy of keeping the students in the classroom, because I believe that the more we can do to keep them in the classroom and raise their skills, the less discipline that you have down the road.
The thinking goes, a student can learn more when they're in the classroom, not when they're out of school serving a suspension. For Lehman, the achievement gap and the discipline gap go hand in hand. So if she can get teachers to identify students who are having trouble and then provide assistance like tutoring or counseling or even switching up when they start school so they're not tardy all the time, she thinks then the number of suspensions will start to shrink. Still, that statistic I brought up a couple minutes ago, the one about how black students are three times more likely to be suspended than their white peers, Lehman knows it's true.
I mean, I've seen teachers who cannot handle African-American students, and they do send them out. I mean, I'm not going to say, oh, no, it's, you know, we don't do that at all. But I don't think that that's the majority.
I am just not going to let teachers off the hook. They need training to be effective with our African-American students.
That's Donna Ford, the special education professor at Vanderbilt University.
It can't all reside in the African-American children. We cannot take on the total responsibility for these negative outcomes. We must look at what's going on in schools.
For those teachers who do over-discipline African-American students, Principal Cynthia Lehman has what the district calls a courageous conversation with the teacher to point out the disparity and come up with a way to fix it so that suspensions are a last resort. You're listening to a State of Opportunity special on race on Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. For every suspension a student experiences, the likelihood that they'll drop out increases. Even being suspended once in ninth grade ups your chances of dropping out from 16% to 32%. Gary Orfield directs the Civil Rights Project at UCLA. He says a stat like that should concern not just young Black and Latino males, but everybody.
A young man who doesn't graduate from high school has no future in our society. So what are these guys doing to live? They're not doing anything that we would like to know about. And they're doing things that have huge costs to the society. We have to give them better alternatives.
Let's hear about one type of alternative to suspensions that's being used at Ypsilanti High School. If you are on the verge of being suspended and you go to Ypsilanti High School, chances are you'll end up in the conflict resolution room. It's a pretty bare bones room, just a small couch, some chairs, a plant. For decorations, there are signs and homemade posters with drawings of shooting stars and slogans like "Together we can" and "Think before you speak."
It's wrong. This is where we come in with problems and leave with no problems. You just get everything off your chest, basically.
That's a 17-year-old Ypsilanti senior named Darion Reeves. He's one of the peer mediation counselors at the high school, and he was trained by this woman, Margaret Rohr.
We have trained student mediators who are called in to sit down with two disputants to discuss whatever the conflict might be. I sit in the room next door with the door open between the mediation room and my office. So while the students are handling the mediation, I'm able to overhear everything right next door. So there's always adult supervision.
Rohr says she uses peer mediation for lower level conflicts between students, more of a prevention tactic than anything. But if trouble is brewing and a fight seems imminent, which, by the way, is definite grounds for suspension, Rohr says that's when she'll use something called restorative justice.
Restorative practices basically establish a complete paradigm shift from traditional discipline.
In traditional discipline, Rohr says, the focus is on rules and punishment. With restorative practices, the focus is on harm done and relationships. So if someone starts a fight in a hall, let's say, a restorative circle would include everyone who was affected by that fight. The teacher who had to stop class to break it up, the staff member who had to stop what she was doing to call the parents, and on and on. Everyone gets in a circle with the student who caused the harm in the middle. The student then has to listen as one by one he hears how his actions impacted those around him.
When a student starts a fight, something's going on with that student. They're not doing well. And the last thing they need is to be removed from the school environment where there's a stable environment and caring adults. Removing them to the community where typically there isn't a lot of supervision, if any, leaves that child just kind of in a limbo.
If it all sounds a little kumbaya-ish, you're not alone.
I thought it was weird. I didn't think it was going to work. But, you know, because usually talking doesn't really work with me.
Cheyenne is 14 years old and a freshman at Ypsilanti High. She has a few suspensions under her belt already, one this year for arguing with a teacher and a few in middle school for fighting. Dressed in a black top with sparkly hot pink sequins, Cheyenne seems like a sweet girl, but she admits she has a temper. Earlier this year, things got pretty heated between her and some of her girlfriends, and it looked like there was going to be a fight. So she and her friends found themselves talking to Margaret Rohr in the conflict resolution room.
It was me and three other girls. It was all a big misunderstanding, and we ended up coming here, and all four of us and Miss Rohr, we all talked about it, and we all became friends again. And I think it's easier to talk about it when you have another party involved that doesn't really know what's going on and isn't picking favorites.
Cheyenne says the combination of restorative circles and peer mediation has made her calmer, less quick to judge. Without irony, she quotes a poster on the wall behind her when she tells me, thanks to Miss Rohr, she now thinks before she speaks. Rohr tells me since they opened the conflict resolution room last October, there's been a slight reduction in the number of fights and suspensions. If the conflict resolution room hadn't been open, she estimates there would have been 120 more days of suspensions handed out. 120 more days where some kids wouldn't have been in school. Coming up, what's it like to be one of the few minorities in your school? We'll find out in 10 minutes. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer Guerra. All this hour, we are looking at race and culture and its impact on children. We just heard about disparities in schools with somewhat diverse populations, but most schools in Michigan are highly segregated. Gary Orfield, director of the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, says that's a real problem in Michigan schools.
Michigan is an absolute national leader in segregated schools.
True, Michigan doesn't have any actual segregated schools on the books. Those went out a long time ago. But de facto segregation is very real. And it's hard to argue that we're moving toward a post-racial society in Michigan when black kids mostly go to school with other black kids, Latinos with Latinos, whites with whites.
One thing that people really need to understand is it's almost never just segregation by race or ethnicity. It's almost always what we call double segregation. So high concentrated black or Latino schools tend to have concentrated poverty as well. So there's a double level of segregation, both from the white population and from the middle class population.
And for a lot of Latino students, Orfield says it's triple segregation, segregation by race, poverty, and language.
Almost anybody would agree, I think, that just sitting next to a white kid isn't magical, but being in a middle-class school where most of the kids are going to college and everybody's preparing them to succeed there, that is magical.
You know, we have this growing diversity in the country, and yet we're staring at these kids who are in the minority who will soon not be in the minority anymore. They will be, in a very real sense, the future of the country. And they're in these schools that are separate and unequal. What does that mean for the future of the country?
It means that in many parts of our country, the average level of education will decline as whites are replaced by, particularly by Latinos, which is the underlying dynamic of our population now. If we don't figure out how to educate those people who are actually here in our country, who are, who came here to better themselves, we will create new barrios and ghettos with people who have no future in this society and no real connection to it. And we'll pay huge costs for that for generations to come.
We've heard from a lot of adults this hour. Teachers, principals, community workers, researchers, all talking about the impact of race and culture on students. But what do students think? I mean, how do you talk about differences like race if all you see day in and day out in your school and in your neighborhood are people who look just like you? You're going to hear from a number of students, Latino, African American, and white, about what it means to grow up in a de facto segregated world. We'll start with the students at Pershing and New Tech High Schools, where more than 90% of the population is black.
My name is Nisha George. I'm 16 and I'm in 10th grade.
My name is Nicholas Gordon.
My name is Erica Bland. I feel like I like going to a African-American school, but I would want to experience different races so that I can be comfortable. I've been comfortable around white people, so I don't have a problem, but, you know, Mexicans, you know, Bengali and all that, I just want to be comfortable around them.
It kind of leaves a lot of us curious about different races, and you know when you go to college, it's a lot of different people, so stereotypes do come about when you try to talk to someone that's not of your race or something that you don't know.
Well, I feel kind of comfortable that it's nice seeing my own race because, like, when we see different people, well, we feel uncomfortable because they're different from us. But I feel that that doesn't prepare us for college, because college, we see all races that's coming in there. So how do we deal with a different race?
My name is Andrea Salcido. I'm 15, and I go to Cesar Chavez Academy High School.
My name is Alexa Carrillo. I'm Mexican, and I'm 15 years old.
My name is Mariana Vasquez, and I'm 14.
My name is Eddie Solis. I'm 17. I'm Chicano, and I go to CCA.
It's really nice because we all understand each other, and we speak the same language.
We could all speak in Spanish if you want, and then we could like talk in English if you want to.
It would help if there's more students, just to get to know other races.
We actually got a couple of other races besides Mexicans in our school, but not a lot. But I think it would have been better if we had some other kinds so we can learn more about them, like share stories.
Like this one time we went to the movies as a field trip, and then like we were all just standing there, and there was like these like a white school right there, and then it was us, and then they like started laughing. They were like, oh, look at them. I bet one of them is a Maria and a Jose. So they, like, started saying it, like, Maria. And then some girl, like, turned around. And then they're like, you see? Like, just started laughing, you know?
My name is Michaela Struck. I'm a 12th grader at Seaholm High School.
I'm Austin Philbin. I'm in 12th grade.
My name is Leah Levine.
I'm Jason Mondry.
I'm Michael Bertrand. I'm a junior.
We're a predominantly white school. I think that our school is pretty cliquey, and I do find, without a doubt, that race plays into that.
We all eat lunch in the cafeteria, and probably the most prevalent example of how, like, the races at Seaholm, like, divide up against each other would be in the cafeteria, how usually there's, like, an entirely black table that sits together just made of all black students, and normally it's just a bunch of white students at tables.
I just wish that wasn't something that we held so valuable, like, that would be the determining thing as to who you sit with at the lunch table.
To be honest, and this is not a good reflection of our school at all, so I feel a little guilty saying this, but I was a freshman sitting in the cafeteria, and at lunch we had an equally loud table of boys and girls and an equally loud table of, yeah, and our one of our hall monitors walked right by us to discipline the black people.
Something that I think one of my teachers has mentioned to me before is that when a lot of kids leave this sort of Birmingham bubble and they go to a different college or something, they're kind of, it's like a big step, you know what I mean, to be thrown into a much more diverse mix, you know what I mean, and have to, and you know, and interact with people that are a lot different than you, than you're used to. And it's sort of interesting, but I think like being in this situation that we are now, it just makes a lot of us like very close-minded almost.
Yeah, I almost feel like to fix the problem, you have to address the problem. We can't admit that we have a race problem, so therefore we can't even fix it because we don't acknowledge that it's there.
After listening to Michael, Andrea, Tanisha, and all the other teenagers who were so willing to open up and share their thoughts on race, I couldn't help but wonder, if Michigan schools are among the most segregated in the country, what would it be like to be a minority at one of those schools, the odd man out, the one who so obviously looks different from everybody else? So we gave a recorder to a young woman named Kennedy King, and we asked her to reflect on what it's like to be in the minority at her school. She attends a high school in Southeast Michigan, where she is one of the few African-American students. Here's Kennedy.
Your narrator and host, Kennedy Camille King, ladies and gentlemen.
What'd you say, Mom?
15 years old. I'm in 10th grade. I'm a sophomore.
Class of 2015. What?
Okay, right now, at this very moment, my favorite song is CeeLo Green's One for the Road. It's like, it starts off, it is like, I have millenniums of material and rivers of emotion
that's enlightening to swimming. And my sister, Sierra, she's my best friend in the whole widest world.
Hey, everybody.
The other one is in college. Her name is Destiny.
I like poetry. I love music. I love to dance.
Oh, America's Next Top Model is on. You gotta go watch. My favorite show.
Bye. It's our classes and scene. All of Sierra's friends that intertwine themselves in with our family are of African American descent, and all of my friends that tend to come over and, you know, mingle with the family are white. For my white friends, it's usually always like, do you wash your hair every day?
those kind of questions. And I mean, I always have my hair in braids like this. Do you wash your hair when you have braids? Yes, yes, I do. Are those dreads? No, they're not. Why do you never wear your fro out to school? It's like, yo, I'm gonna do whatever I want to with my hair. Black people, it's always matters of the voice, basically. Like, the voice and whether or not you came from Detroit. Because the way I speak, many people think that I'm, like, trying to be bougie or something like that. I don't know. Like, again, it's just me speaking proper English, how I was raised. I mean, my voice does change from group to group. I've noticed that. But I think it's my comfortability with you. Because it changes with anybody. Like, I'll go into a more relaxed Kennedy when I'm with my friends. Like, if I really know you like that. Excuse me while I grab a snack. Now it's off to do homework. It's raining and thunderstorming outside. I love the rain and thunderstorms. I know this is like a really touchy subject or whatever, but I think that's why so many people of African American descent, when they grow up in a school like I do, I think that's why historically black colleges are so successful. I mean, they may have the same drama, but I don't know, it feels nicer to be among your own, the ones that understand their, you know, your familiarities. Close this window before my carpet
gets soaked. Hey guys, just got home from track practice and school, of course, since it's Monday. That's the washer going in the background. I think my school doesn't, you know, deal with the issue of race. They, it's kind of like a, I don't know, don't ask, don't tell policy, I guess. It makes me feel like the school doesn't care. I mean, how everybody else, I don't know how everybody else feels, but to me, it just, it makes me not like the school altogether, because, I mean, you avoid this one little issue and it turns into a whole heap of mess. And I mean, I've always asked the question, like, I don't understand how adults expect, like, kids to settle this problem, like, when they go into the real world, like, with the, and it's a problem that should have been settled generations long, long past.
As you've heard this hour, the issue of race is complicated. It can't be boiled down into sound bites and simple statements. It's dynamic. It's messy. Being born Black or Latino or Native American shouldn't play a major role in determining your life outcomes, any more than being born white should. Not too long ago, then-Senator Barack Obama shined a spotlight on race in a speech he gave in Philadelphia. In it, he talked about segregated schools and discrimination, racial tensions, anger in the Black community, resentment among whites. He ended his speech with a story about a young white woman named Ashley. Ashley's mom had cancer, and the family had to file for bankruptcy after she lost her job and health benefits. Ashley says she joined the Obama campaign because she wanted to help others in similar situations.
Now, Ashley might have made a different choice. Perhaps somebody told her along the way that the source of her mother's problems were blacks who were on welfare and too lazy to work, or Hispanics who were coming into the country illegally. But she didn't. She sought out allies in her fight against injustice. Anyway, Ashley finishes her story and then goes around the room and asks everyone else why they're supporting the campaign. They all have different stories and different reasons. Many bring up a specific issue. And finally, they come to this elderly black man who's been sitting there quietly the entire time. And Ashley asks him why he's there. And he doesn't bring up a specific issue. He does not say healthcare or the economy. He does not say education or the war. He does not say that he was there because of Barack Obama. He simply says to everyone in the room, I am here because of Ashley.
What we're talking about here is bigger than any particular party or campaign. It's about equality. Racial disparities aren't going to disappear overnight. It will take a lot of work to ensure that all children, no matter what color their skin or what zip code they live in, all children have the opportunity to succeed. We should do it, not just for Ashley, but four.
Shakira Harris-Bay.
Nisha George.
Sandra Salcido.
Erica Bland.
Michaela Struck.
Austin Philbin.
Destiny.
Katie.
Leah Levine.
Jason Mondry.
Banana Vasquez.
Alexa Carrillo.
Rashaya.
Darian.
Michael Bertrand.
Eddie Solis.
Kennedy King.
Navia Daniel.
Nicholas Gordon.
You've been listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. This documentary was informed by the Public Insight Network. Thanks to Dustin Dwyer, Sarah Alvarez, Kimberly Springer, and Bridget Nile. Sarah Hewlett edited the show. Tamar Charney is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer Guerra.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.